Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
A lot of these cases are ones that Alaskan communities haven't forgotten, and some will never forget, so we can't forget about them either.
DNA evidence leads to a suspect in a decades-old sexual assault case. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, what is keeping mushers from entering the Iditarod? Some say it's economics.
We go without so the dogs can go with, and that's just the lifestyle.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
A quick warning before this first story. It mentions sexual violence against a child. That's because after a child sexual assault case languished unsolved for almost 3 decades, DNA evidence collected in 1994 has finally led to a suspect. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, it's a case that involved a 5-year-old girl who was raped at an Anchorage park.
Lawrence Andrew Lukianoff was indicted last week by an Anchorage grand jury. He is now 52 and was a young man in his early 20s when the assault took place. The State Department of Law, which sought the indictment, says Anchorage police initially investigated the case 28 years ago, but it went cold until evidence was tested in 2020. The DNA sample was in a collection of sexual assault kits tested as part of the Capital Project, a statewide initiative to analyze untested kits gathered from 47 police departments. When the 1994 DNA evidence was tested, it linked the assault to a suspect in the lower 48. Police then reopened the investigation, and the Department of Law's Office of Special Prosecutions presented the case to a grand jury. Aaron McCarthy, the statewide cold case prosecutor, says this indictment sends an important message that despite the passage of time, cases like this one are still worthy of attention.
A lot of these cases are ones that Alaskan communities haven't forgotten, and some will never forget, so we can't forget about them either.
The girl who was raped in 1994 is now in her early 30s. And while McCarthy can't talk about the woman in this case, she says, for the most part, when a cold case is closed, it gives survivors of sexual assault some peace of mind.
Often victims will feel like no one cared or no one followed up on their reports, and that simply isn't the case. There's a sense of validation as well. Some victims who never knew the identity of their assailant can take comfort in knowing who that person is now and not feeling like they're always looking over their shoulder as well.
While the DNA tests connect Lukianoff to the unsolved 1994 case, this is not the first time he's been charged with sexual assault. He was convicted of a similar crime in 1996, which took place at Cheney Lake and involved a 6-year-old girl. Lukianoff is also listed as a registered sex offender in Washington State, Montana, and Colorado. He was arrested on Monday and is awaiting extradition to Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Alaska state troopers have released more information about an incident last month in which a woman fell from a Richardson Highway bridge over the Tanana River near Delta Junction. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, she's still being treated for injuries she sustained.
Troopers have completed their investigation into the February 18th incident, and on Tuesday they released the name of the victim, 22-year-old Kaylee Slagle of Eielson Air Force Base. A base spokesperson says she's an airman first class assigned to the 354th Security Forces Squadron. Troopers also released some information Tuesday about how Slagle fell from the bridge deck and landed on an ice shelf 30 feet below. Spokesperson Austin McDaniel says Slagle and two companions reportedly were out and about sightseeing that day when they decided to stop and check out the bridge.
Somebody slipped and fell on ice and unfortunately went over the bridge.
McDaniel said one of Slagle's companions called for help at around 5:45 a.m. First responders from Fort Greely and Delta Junction area agencies rescued Slagle and transported her to Fairbanks Memorial Hospital in critical condition. A hospital official said Tuesday that Slagle is still there undergoing treatment and that her condition has been upgraded to stable. McDaniel says pedestrians should be extremely careful walking on any icy surface, especially on a bridge with no sidewalk and only waist-high guardrails like the one over the Tanana in Big Delta.
You know, we don't want people falling off of bridges or falling over cliffs or embankments, so just, you know, be cautious of your footing and ensure that you are acting in a safe manner for the area that you're in.
McDaniel says neither Slagle nor her companions have been charged with any offenses related to the incident. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
There are just 33 teams signed up to run this year's Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. It's the smallest group in the race's history, and mushers say there's a number of factors leading to the tiny pool of competitors. A major one is finances. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports on the issue and what organizers see as the solutions.
Outside at his kennel in Knik, Iditarod musher Jason Mackey is assessing his dwindling supply of dog food. His freezer has just a few slabs of frozen salmon. There's a few boxes of frozen ground beef in the snow next to a few frozen whole king salmon. His kibble is almost gone, and he's not looking forward to a trip to the feed store. Not in this economy.
2004, I ran my first Iditarod. We paid $28 a bag for the red paw kibble that we feed today. And today, that bag of dog food's $68.
Mackey is racing the Iditarod this year, but he says it's harder than ever to keep up with costs. Prices on kibble and beef have disproportionately shot up in the last few years, and salmon from the Yukon River have been harder to come by with recent fisheries closures. Mackey says he's been in the sport long enough to learn how to adapt.
We go without so the dogs can go with, and that's just the lifestyle.
But is that sort of self-sacrifice going to keep attracting mushers to Alaska's iconic 1,000-mile sled dog race? The mushing community is divided over just how serious this year's low sign-up is for the future of the Iditarod. 15 years ago, nearly 100 mushers lined up for the start, compared to the record low 33 this year. Iditarod CEO Rob Urbach says he's not panicked yet.
This year's a little bit of a strange year. We just had a number of people taking time off. We've had a number of people that have timed out. You know, we don't really think it's necessarily a trend.
Five-time champion Dallas Seavey is sitting out this year's race to spend time with family, as are mushers Aaron Burmeister and former champion Joar Olsom. There's also an older generation of mushers stepping away this year, like Jeff King, Martin Boozer, and Ali Zirkel. While CEO Urbach is hopeful for the race's future, he still says this year's low turnout is a wake-up call, and the Iditarod organization has some ideas for developing the next generation of mushers. He says the Iditarod plans to start a shorter race for younger mushers that starts at the same time as the 1,000-miler. And to help with costs, it's looking into organizing food-buying co-ops to help mushers save a few bucks on their kibble. Three-time race champion Mitch Seavey is sitting out this year's race to let his body recover, but he thinks the organization should be doing more.
You know, it's no secret. The Iditarod has a $4 million budget. It makes me wonder why the purse isn't bigger and why the mushers aren't being supported.
CV thinks the Iditarod should host monthly races to keep enthusiasm for the sport high throughout the winter and do more to grow the fan base. He also says increasing the prize purse would help, something last year's third place finisher Jesse Holmes agrees with.
It gives more opportunity for, you know, a professional musher to go out and race for purse money, which is huge.
Holmes says that top mushers like himself will plan out their race seasons based on prize money. The Iditarod's total prize purse, divided among finishers, has held steady at about $500,000 since 2018. It's about half of what it was 15 years ago, even without accounting for significant inflation. Urbach, the CEO, says the Iditarod hopes to boost the purse, but attracting new sponsors has been difficult. Several large corporate sponsors have pulled out in the last decade, some after they were pressured by animal rights groups who believe long-distance dog sled racing amounts to animal abuse. On top of that, the organization is dealing with its own cost increases.
Inflation disproportionately hit us. You know, our supply chain costs have gone up 30% over the last 18 months, so it's pretty significant for us as well.
One potential solution to help keep the Iditarod viable, he says, is state funding. He says he's in discussions with the state legislature to step in and help support the race financially and keep Alaska's state sports strong. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Lex Trinan.
And the Iditarod kicks off Saturday with the ceremonial start in Anchorage. Find all of our race coverage at alaskapublic.org/Iditarod and check out our podcast, The Iditapod, wherever you listen to podcasts. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage Fire Department assists with an unusual rescue.
Not often do we have an opportunity to help out sled dogs who have been involved in vehicle accidents and end up on an ice floe.
That's right, on an ice floe. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
More than a year into the war in Ukraine, Alaska's government is doing its part by sending aid in the form of Alaska seafood. KMXT's Brian Venwa reports the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute is handling the state's food distribution.
Bruce Schachtler is ASME's Food Aid Program and Development Director. He says while ASME doesn't own any of the seafood, they've helped manage the state's aid programs. That includes sending over $300,000 worth of Alaskan seafood, or about 3,600 cases of canned pink salmon, to Ukraine.
We do things on behalf of the legislature of the state of Alaska. Most recently, at the request of the legislature, we sent three containers of canned salmon over to Ukraine.
When the state government decides to send aid, they set a budget, and ASME solicits bids from companies across Alaska. Companies then bid on the sale and offer stock at competitive rates to ensure a maximized amount of product. The state has aided in several disasters over the years, and through ASME has sent food to the Philippines after devastating typhoons and areas suffering food insecurity in Africa and the Middle East as well. Schachtler says ASME has a history of running the state's aid programs.
ASME's been facilitating humanitarian aid for the last 20 years.
ASME was asked about domestic food insecurity at a recent presentation to the State House Fisheries Special Committee, particularly as the state has been slow to send food stamps or process applications since August. Schachtler says ASME would be interested in sending food to those in need across the state, but they need funding and approval from the legislature first.
I've discussed it with the State Department. Now, I've discussed it with a few members of Congress in Washington, D.C., but I have not been contacted or heard anything further than that.
If the state decides to purchase domestic seafoods for Alaskans in this year's supplemental budget, aid could be sent to food banks as soon as next week. But if aid isn't included until the 2024 regular budget, folks would have to wait at least until July. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venwa.
The state of Alaska is proposing to sell more old-growth trees on its land in southern southeast Alaska. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, state managers say they're obligated to conduct the sales despite pushback from community members.
The State Department of Natural Resources' five-year harvest plan proposes timber sales equaling about 62 million board feet. That includes clear-cutting about 2,600 acres of old-growth trees.
The old-growth is marketable currently.
Greg Staunton is the state's area forester for Southeast. The Division of Forestry seeks timber sales as part of its constitutional mandate to pursue using natural resources on public lands. Old-growth logging is controversial for its impacts on the environment and subsistence food sources, like deer and salmon. The U.S. Forest Service froze old growth sales in 2021, and this year restored the roadless rule, protecting thousands of old growth acres from logging. But federal protections don't apply to state land. And Staunton says the state doesn't have much choice. He says there just isn't much marketable young growth available in the state's inventory. The proposed sales are in a dozen main areas in the region. Some projects could get started as soon as this year, and others are still in review. Most are near towns. Staunton says that's where the state owns land in Southeast.
A lot of the land base that we've been charged with managing here is in proximity to where communities are. And that's a product of how we were granted land at statehood.
One logging project that's set to begin this year is a controversial timber sale in Whale Pass on Prince of Wales Island. The state would clear cut about 300 acres of old growth near town and build 4 new miles of logging roads.
That decision has been made. I think we have a product out there that's workable. It does not satisfy all people that are, brought their concerns forward. I recognize that.
Some of the Whale Pass logging is within city limits, and most residents oppose it. Staunton says he takes public feedback seriously. He says they've walked the site and considered any potential risks. In the end, it's state land.
While it's adjacent to the community of Whale Pass, and we recognize that, is also legislatively classified state forest. So that's one of its purpose is to be used for providing forest resources, of which, timber is one of the key things that it's meant to provide.
Jimmy Greeley is with the homeowners group Friends of Whale Pass. He spoke with KRBD last fall.
Basically, it was cut the whole clear cut the hillside and then kind of make Whale Pass not look very, very green anymore.
Another group in opposition is the Prince of Wales Community Advisory Council, representing over a dozen communities and tribal governments on the island. They wrote a letter to the state with concerns that the logging is above homes.
They thought to themselves, surely they can't be serious.
That's Katie Rooks. She's with the environmental group Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. They oppose the state's entire 5-year plan for several reasons. She says the clear cutting would scar up land near communities that are pursuing tourism, and there are some projects that are listed as TBD, to be decided.
There's a lot of ambiguity. Okay, there's a lot of incomplete information with this particular state 5-year plan. For several of these sales, they don't list the acreage, the board feet, or the road miles. In fact, they say in here that the last 3 years of projected sales in this document are uncertain.
The state's timber sales in Southern Southeast cater to two main logging companies, Alcan and Ketchikan, and Viking Lumber on Prince of Wales Island. The two have been requesting the harvests. Staunton says smaller mills couldn't build the infrastructure needed.
Well, in the larger sales where there is significant road to be built, bigger companies, they have more capital resources that they can bring to bear.
The state's Southeast timber sale plan is described in a 36-page document that includes project maps and other details. The public comment deadline is listed as February 28th, but Staunton says they'll continue to accept feedback beyond that. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
One sled dog was rescued from an ice floe and another is still missing after a Kenai Peninsula musher's trailer disconnected from his truck after the Open World Championship sprint races at the Fur Rendezvous celebration in Anchorage last weekend. Frank Haberman of Clam Gulch was driving his truck southbound from Anchorage on Monday with his sled dogs in a trailer. The trailer became unhooked on the Seward Highway and the doors opened, letting the sled dogs loose around mile 105 near Indian Creek. Here's Anchorage Fire Department Assistant Chief Alex Boyd.
It was low tide at the time, and the dogs sort of scrambled after the accident, obviously being scared and getting out away from the truck and trailer.
The fire department sent crews to help rescue the dogs and to make sure the people stopping to help were safe. Boyd says as the tide came in, one of the dogs tried to find higher ground.
And it just happened to be a piece of ice that started moving once the tide came up far enough.
The ice started floating out into Cook Inlet. He says they used water rescue bags to get the dog back uninjured.
Safely a little cold and a little bit wet, but back to shore.
Another dog, Donna, ran toward Girdwood and still has not been returned home. Haberman, the musher, says people have spotted Donna at Indian Creek and they've set up a trap to get her back. He worries because she's skittish and says he hopes she's found before something happens to her. By the way, Haberman and his team placed 11th in last weekend's Open World Championship. Discussions on slugs and mushrooms abounded in Petersburg last weekend. For the first time in 4 years, a group of farmers, scientists, and entrepreneurs gathered in person for the Southeast Alaska Farmers Summit. Every other year, a different community hosts the event. KFSK's Shelby Herbert reports.
Dozens of people from all over the United States crowd the aisles of the Petersburg Lutheran Church. Countless others attend virtually on Zoom. They've come to share resources and best practices on farming in the cold, rainy climate of Southeast Alaska. Rain-loving slugs are especially challenging for regional growers. Casey Reichardt is a researcher from Oregon State University. His Friday slug identification workshop brought in a huge crowd.
I recently found out that slug slime is a liquid crystal, and so is human mucus. And my next thought was, what then is a booger?
The Southeast Alaska Farmers Summit has grown a lot since it began in Petersburg in 2015. That first year, it was a two-day event with only about 35 participants. Now, there's about 100 people attending in person. Jonathan Rubo and Lucetto Hagen are two of them. It was their first time in Petersburg. Rubo says the gathering presented him with a lot of food for thought on composting.
So my big challenge is tapping into the waste stream as a resource to provide for farmers and growers. And so, you know, trying to divert that waste from the landfills, transfer stations, and make that available for locals.
O'Hagan works as a commercial lender, but aspires to become a farmer herself. She says she learned about how challenging it is for Southeast Alaska farmers to secure the funds to build their business.
And from the family farm perspective, it's probably financing streams. So just letting people know that credit unions are available to help them with financing needs.
Wiyanga Angie Mendbayar traveled to Petersburg from Juneau for the conference. She stayed in one of the cannery bunkhouses for the weekend. It was an affordable option for some of the participants.
I guess I'm just getting a firsthand rural Alaska experience.
Yeah.
Like for two nights I couldn't get good sleep because there's no heat.
Mendbayar came for the mushrooms. She has her own startup for mushroom products and gave a presentation on a recent USDA mushroom study.
Yeah, I had a little mushroom farm, but my cultivator is moving out of state. So my goal is, how can I bring more access to these local foods? And can I make them into something that they can eat? Or I make reishi treats and reishi rooibos drinks and like just being creative with what I can make with small farm products.
For over a decade, Mendbayar has worked in environmental research and activism. She's interested in replacing single-use packaging and other types of plastic waste with biodegradable materials derived from mushrooms. She says Southeast Alaska is a particularly exciting place to explore these ideas.
You know, all these trees and forests we see, we live in a fungal heaven. Their roots are connected with mycelium through mycorrhizal network. We don't see them in our eyes, but it's everywhere. The spores are in the air, you know, the roots are connecting underneath us. So when you walk into the forest, it feels you through their like nervous system, which is fungus. and mushroom gives me hope.
The Southeast Alaska Farmers Summit was funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and dozens of regional nonprofits. The next summit won't be held for at least another year. In Petersburg, I'm Shelby Herbert.
Students across the Kenai Peninsula have been practicing their jazz standards and tuning their instruments in preparation for the annual Link Up concert. As KDLL Sabine Pooks reports, they'll be joining musicians from the Kenai Peninsula Orchestra for two concerts this weekend.
The local Link Up program is a collaboration between the Kenai Peninsula Orchestra, 10 local elementary schools, and Carnegie Hall. It started almost a decade ago when orchestra members Sue Biggs and her husband Jack Will visited Carnegie Hall in New York and fell in love with the program.
It's a program that they have established to connect young children with orchestras.
Carnegie works with over 100 music programs around the world, according to the Link Up website. How it works is Carnegie sends music and books to participating schools and orchestras, and they cycle through different themes every year. This year's theme is the Orchestra Swings, which showcases jazz music. Big says kindergartners through sixth graders have been spending the last 2 months learning the curriculum, and this weekend will sing and play recorder on stage with the adult orchestra, including I've Got Rhythm, as sung by third graders from Redoubt Elementary School. Biggs is a former music teacher. She says it makes a difference for kids to be part of the music rather than just listening to it or learning about it in the classroom.
As a teacher in the music room, I would talk about different instruments like bassoons and oboes and horns and trombones and things, but they never saw them except maybe we'd watch a video or maybe we'd have a special guest come in and play something.
She says seeing the instruments in action and joining in is a whole different world. That meant a lot to her when she was a high school student, playing the violin with her college orchestra.
Playing with people who actually were community members who did this as a living, that was very meaningful for me.
She says it's fun for the members of the Kenai Peninsula Orchestra, too. The concerts will be the first the orchestra has played together since the pandemic started. The orchestra rehearses at the Kenai Peninsula Fairgrounds in Inilchik, halfway between members on the Central and Southern Peninsula.
It's just been like coming home. To come to the fairgrounds and see all of our music friends. So for us, it's a treat too that we've been back to gathering together. And I know it's going to be really exciting when we're back playing on the stage together too. And then to have the excitement and energy of the kids just adds so much more. And chaotic. It's all fun.
There's a Link Up concert at Kenai Central High School for students from the Central Peninsula at 7 p.m. Friday. And then the next day, there will be a concert for Homer area students at the Homer High School Mariner Theater. Both concerts are free and open to the public. Big says about 300 students are participating this year. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Rhonda McBride and Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Brian Venois in Kodiak, Angela Denning and Shelby Herbert in Petersburg, and Sabine Pooks in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Feit produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Planned gifts as a bequest to your local station builds a legacy that is long-lasting. Thanks for considering this option. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.